Do you have any comments about distributivism?
Absolutely. Distributivism. Catholic. Yeah, and in fact, did I plant you in the audience? This is crazy. I have a book coming out next month. No, actually, I've got a book with a guy named Jonathan Witt that's coming out next month called The Hobbit Party, The Vision of Freedom That Tolkien Got and the West Forgot. It's about J.R.R. Tolkien's political and economic views in The Lord of the Rings, The Silmarillion, and The Hobbit, and all his private letters. It's actually an amazing guide on these questions. And so there was this idea that a lot of people, and it's very popular with conservative Catholics and kind of literarily oriented Christians would be the best way to describe it. And it's an idea that there's a third way that's neither sort of free market capitalism nor socialism called distributism. And it's kind of hard to define, but it's essentially the idea that what you want is lots of little platoons, lots of people owning productive property. That was the image. And the two thinkers that are most identified with this are G.K. Chesterton and Hilary Belloc, a British intellectual, early 20th century. And it's a kind of a complicated issue. I think there's some important insights in distributism, especially the importance of the family. They argue that economies, we ought to focus on the family as the fundamental unit of production rather than the individual. They saw a lot of the things that were coming. But to make a long story short, Belloc and Chesterton had a lot of kind of confusing economic ideas. So, for instance, Belloc writes an essay called An Essay on the Restoration of Property. And his thinking about the capitalist and the worker, if you read that essay, it's online, is exactly the same as Marx had in Communist Manifesto. Not because Belloc was a Marxist, but because it was just in the air in the late 19th and early 20th centuries is that people thought in terms of a sort of master-slave relationship between the capitalist and the worker. They didn't anticipate that, you know, you could be a GM worker working in a factory and also own GM stock, you know, that sort of thing. And so they didn't. So they just had a kind of a misguided understanding of the way economics works. And so my argument, and we talk about that in this Tolkien book in detail, and the reason is because a lot of people said Tolkien was a distributist. And we argue, I think, conclusively, that he clearly was not, but that you have to kind of get down into the details to understand this. And so it's an important question. And a lot of Christian intellectuals are into this right now. And especially what happens is that distributism pops up every time something bad happens in the economy. And so after the financial crisis, everybody started talking about distributism again, which is one of the reasons we wrote this book. So it is a kind of a complicated and important question, but we deal with it there. So it's called distributism or distributivism. Yeah.
Do you think crony capitalism, ironically, plays into the zero-sum game philosophy?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly does feed that. Crony capitalism it's not socialism and it's not really free market capitalism. What it is a system in which large economic players and government regulators work together in cahoots. And so you can think of it as, you're a large corporation that's doing really, really well. And people often think, well, if you're a large corporation, you don't want regulations, right? No, that's wrong. You want regulations that you can afford, and you want regulations that you can write. And especially if you can write them in such a way that it prevents small competitors from getting into the market. And so this is why it's like, why is GM and GE, why are they supporting these weird regulations? Why are these big medical organizations support, you know, the socialization of medicine? This is why. If you're the company that gets to write the regulations on your industry, that's a sweet deal. And that's actually the thing that I think we're dealing with now. I don't think we're dealing with... the danger is not 20th century, you know, Stalinist socialism. It's cronyism, in which you get a weird kind of hybrid of these large economic actors and especially the federal government. And I do think that it ends up, and unfortunately, it ends up actually being a zero-sum game. Remember, I didn't say there are no zero-sum games. What I said is that free exchange isn't a zero-sum game, right? But in this case, what cronyism does is it essentially limits competition. It doesn't tend to work. If you think about it, it's sort of a losing proposition because lots of large corporations are now sort of moribund. It's the corporations that have only existed 10 or 15 or 20 years that are actually quite vibrant. And so in many ways, high technology prevents it, but large energy corporations and large appliance companies and things like that and large financial institutions especially are unfortunately very much in cahoots. I mean, I live in Washington, D.C., and it's just absolutely unbelievable. There's just this weird hybrid blob. To give one reference from Tolkien, if you read The Hobbit, the master of Lake Town is both the mayor and he owns all the companies too. And so there's a perfect kind of hybrid of the state and the private corporation. That's what cronyism is. And it is, in many ways, a sort of zero-sum game.
Yes, I did just read your book, Money, Greed, and God. And I loved your segment on foreign aid and how it actually hurts the country compared to helping it. And in your opinion, what would be your solution to use that money and promote a country instead of tearing it down?
Yeah, what we're doing? And I wouldn't go so far as to say every dollar of foreign aid in every case does bad rather than good. It's a complicated situation. But I do think the foreign aid regime that was set up with the IMF and the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, more often than not, not only don't work, but actually do more harm than good. And so if you think about it, the way the incentive is set up, if you're a country, right, and so let's say you're a small banana republic in Africa, and you're a dictator, right, that is impoverishing your people, where's the money going to go? The International Monetary Fund can't go hand out money in villages. That's not how it works. They have to work with the government. And so what it very often has ended up doing is actually underwriting the dictators that are causing the trouble. And so it just, I think the mechanism is not well set up. And so that's how it can do more harm than good. It doesn't mean all foreign aid for emergency relief and vaccines and things like that are always bad. It's not nearly that simple. There's actually a documentary that's just coming out from the Poverty Cure, which is part of the Acton Institute called Poverty Inc., that y'all should have a screening of that. It's just about to come out that talks about this in much more detail. But I do think if we're going to spend, like let's say we're going to spend all that money anyway, that it would be better spent probably on property reform studies in every particular country, because every country is different. And so it's not like what works here is work exactly well in Nicaragua or something else. But I do think just straight out property reform studies are more likely to do something good rather than bad.
And I think that one of the things you also mentioned in one of your books that I've read is it's just the fact that so much of it doesn't end up in the right place in the first place.
No, it doesn't. And so where would Rand Paul fit in? And so I've got, I actually know personally, I won't give the details, but Rand Paul is a Christian. Like I said, this is for atheist libertarians. And so Rand Paul is a kind of complicated figure. Ron Paul, though, his father, which is actually, he was more of a kind of pure libertarian. They're, I mean, basically Christian libertarians. That would be the sort of easiest way to put it. And so they're not atheists, so they don't have these problems. And so that's why I said this is designed specifically for atheist libertarians. They wouldn't have, if you're a theist, even, you wouldn't have to be a Christian. If you're a theist, these problems aren't nearly as likely to apply. And so notice that Ron Paul, for instance, is from Texas. And so if you talk to libertarians in Texas, unless you're in Austin, there's an exception for Austin, they're more likely to just be, they just don't like the government, they're really small government, they don't hold these kind of philosophical ideas. So this is the problems for those people who want to be both atheists and libertarians, only for them. So Rand Paul would say, great, I'm sure. Oh, John Stossel. Yeah, this should bother him, actually, and I have talked to him. This should bother him. He's not a grizzled, like, hardcore angry atheist, but he basically is an atheist, and he doesn't see any of this stuff. And so what happened is that John Stossel was a consumer reporter for ABC for years. He went to a seminar at the Institute for Humane Studies, which is basically a libertarian think tank in D.C., and realized he'd been using really, really stupid economic arguments his whole life. And so he became a libertarian, and now he does that stuff and does it very well. But he's ethnically Jewish, but not at all religious. And so I would say he's not a committed atheist, but he doesn't believe in God, and he also doesn't really see the problems here. And so these arguments are designed precisely to disturb people like John Stossel. They're the target. Yeah. Yeah.
All right, this is more of an economics question that I would have liked to have asked last night.
Sure.
But it has to do with free trading and exchanging for mutual benefit.
Yes.
Several years ago, someone decided they wanted to auction off one of their kidneys on eBay
for
several million dollars, and it got shut down because there's legislation against selling your organs.
Right.
What are your views on that? Because that is government intervention.
It is. Yeah, and so the government, anything, any law is a government intervention in a sense. And so sometimes we get this idea, I tend not to use this language because it sounds like, well, there's intervention, or, you know, when the law prevents you from killing your neighbor, it's intervening in a sense, right? It would. Trust me, if it's at all functional, it will intervene very quickly, at least punish you after the fact. And so the question is always, okay, so what are legitimate interventions? When is the police power of the state appropriately used, and when is it not? This is the question that, this is the key question when you're dealing in politics that we have to ask and answer and that we don't like to ask. When is it okay to coerce other people and to kill them? That's the question. And if you can't answer that question directly, you're just not thinking clearly about the issue, because that's the question. When is it okay to use tanks and police and force against other people? We all recognize that in most situations, coercion's not the appropriate thing to do. Your atheist coworker, right, that forcing him, right, at gunpoint to come to church and be baptized, probably not the right thing to do. Right? So the question is always, okay, so when is it okay to do that, or even obligatory, and when is it bad? And so that's really the question behind this, and it's so complicated. So I will put it this way. Selling kidneys would drastically, here's the economic point, would drastically lower the price of kidneys and vastly increase the availability of kidneys for people who need them. That is a straightforward economic argument. It's, if you understand supply-demand and the price function, you would see that. The question is whether there is an intrinsic moral problem in selling certain kinds of things. We know there are for certain kinds of things, right? Your body, right? Your children. Selling your children into slavery or your children into poverty or whatever, right? We know that there's certain things, even though the market, you know what? The market, if we could sell our kids on eBay, the price of kids would go way down and their availability would go way up, right? And there'd probably be a lot of takers, a lot of sellers, right? You know? Yeah, exactly. I don't know what the price would be. I mean, they're already so darn expensive, right? Liabilities for 18 years is what an economist put it. But we know that's wrong to do. So here's the moral question. Most people think it's okay to sell your blood, right? Well, why is that? Well, blood is reproducible. And so the question is, okay, God has given us our bodies, and if our bodies are functioning properly, they have an integrity and a proper end. So for instance, there's a psychological condition in which some people feel the need to have their legs amputated, right? And so now they're exercising their freedom, presumably, but they just feel unhappy unless they have their legs amputated, and some doctors have been willing to do this. Most of us know there's something wrong about that, even if you want to do that, right? That intentional mutilation is a violation of the proper end of the thing, right? And so that's why lots of people think, you're crossing that line when you start selling functional organs. It's one thing to volunteer it. It's another thing to make it a commodity. And so this is a very subtle issue, and it has to do with, it's kind of natural law thinking. You have to think in terms of the natural ends for something. And that's why you don't like it when you hear about somebody saying, I want to have my leg cut off voluntarily. Just because they want to do it, you still think that's wrong. You're mutilating yourself, right? And it's because you kind of know that leg is for something. Right, it's for doing something, and it's for you doing something with it. It's not anybody else's leg. And so that's why a lot of people object, even given the economic arguments for selling irreplaceable body parts. You say, yeah, the economics make sense, but it's not one of those things that ought to be sold. It's murky and complicated enough that I do think that people could fairly disagree, but I do think that that argument has some strength.
Yes, I'm very confused about international finance. I know last year we heard a lot about Greece and austerity measures and European Union, and I know there's concern in the United States. One time it was the Saudis owning our assets. Mm-hmm. Now it's the Chinese. These assets are here, the factories, the land. What happens if we default? Why can't we, you know, other than violating the rule of law principle you gave, why can't we just say we can't pay it and so
default. What happens in that case? So there's foreign direct investment, so like a Chinese company owning a plant here, that's a different kind of complicated issue. And so there's a lot of that. There's American-owned plants in China, too. But let's talk about sort of global finance and those kinds of things. So the United States it's very hard to estimate, but somewhere between $33 and $100 trillion in what are called unfunded liabilities. So what this means is that there are things on the books. There are programs in the federal budget that are called entitlements, not because people say, I feel entitled to them. That's the word. They're called entitlements. So what that means is that they're not discretionary. So the Congress doesn't debate how much money is allocated to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid every year. That's not discussed. They don't have sort of discretion over that. Those budgets are determined by the number of recipients around at the time. All right. Well, the problem is that there's still just only so much revenue coming in. So as a result of different demographic changes, when Social Security was implemented, it was about 43 people paying into the system for every one receiving it. It's about 2.5 people paying into it to every one receiving it now, going to 2. So it can't possibly work. Rick Perry was attacked for calling it a Ponzi scheme. And the only reason I can see is because it's by definition a Ponzi scheme. And so it can't work long term. And so all of these entitlement programs have all this sort of promises in out years that the revenue cannot possibly come in for. And so the only way to pay for those is going to be to print money to pay for them. Now, at the same time, we're also the federal government is borrowing lots of money, either from the Fed, weirdly, kind of the Treasury from the Fed, or from private investors or foreign investors, right, who own Treasury bonds and things like that. So the government goes out and they say, okay, I'm going to sell these bonds, they're the 30-year bonds, and they'll give you a return. And somebody buys them because it's really safe. Now, why is that a safe asset? Because owning something from the federal government of the United States is about the safest asset you can have other than owning gold, because it's just known, it's not going to default. And people think, well, it's not going to default because they're less likely to default than anyone else. And if they do default, we're all up a creek without a paddle anyway. So, you know, it seems like the safest bet. So what happens if the federal government just decides, let's say they decide we're going to just start printing money to pay for those liabilities, and we're going to default on those debts. So we're not going to, you know, your treasury bill, it's going to mature and you're not going to get the money for it. Well, it will destroy the value of the currency is what will happen. So dollars won't be worth anything, right, because they're sort of backed by these things. And so what would happen at that point, it's called, because what the government is not going to actually do that. What the government would do is just as it's going to print money to pay for the entitlements, it will print money to pay for those debts. So it's not going to default. It's going to do something called monetizing the debt. And so federal government, unlike state governments, can print its own money, right? And so if we are, say, now it's over $17 trillion in debt, let's say it's $25 trillion or $30 trillion, at some point the federal government is spending all of its money on the interest on the debt, and it can't service it anymore. So it has to print money to pay the interest, and then it just sort of bulks up. So you get so much money in the system that the value of the dollar completely collapses. This isn't theoretical. This is what governments have done historically. They tend not, big governments, there's no reason really to default. They'd much rather, you know, just kind of print money and look like they're paying it off. But the problem is they're getting paid off with dollars that are worth less and less.
That's inflation?
Yeah. So you can think of it as inflation, but it's actually the collapse of the value of the currency itself. And so the definitive book on hyperinflation is called When Money Dies by Andrew Ferguson. It was published in 1975. It's a study of Germany between World War I and World War II. There have been about 12 of these hyperinflationary cycles, and none happened quite the same way twice, unfortunately. So the problem is you never know quite when it's going to happen. But that's what would happen. We would not default on those debts. We would print money and pay them off and destroy the currency first. That's a happy question. Let's...
I'm just wondering if maybe Jesus verified the case for our thinking when he called us sheep, and how our thinking would relate to, you know, the way sheep think, and then in the Old Testament where the 12 went into Canaan and they said that they seemed like, or they felt like they were grasshoppers, and mm-hmm. So they were grasshoppers?
Well, I don't know. Sheep, of course, I don't know how sheep think. But, you know, I'm guessing that you've heard that expression, sheeple, all the sheeple, right? Yeah, is that they just sort of generally follow and they do things sort of according to instinct. And human beings we have bodies, right? We are not merely mammals, but we're vertebrates and all these kinds of things. And so we have those aspects of us. And so the question is, how much of what people actually do is the result of these kind of instinctual things, and how much of what we do is actually the result of really thinking and choosing and evaluating and weighing evidence? If you want to be really depressed about that, you can read on, there's a field of economics I've been reading for the last year called behavioral economics, in which the scientists set up these studies to see how people actually choose. So economists always thought, well, people are always going to choose the thing that's most rational in their self-interest. That was kind of the working assumption in the 19th century. We all know that that's probably not true, right? People do stupid stuff all the time. And so what the behavioral economists do is that they set up experiments, and what you discover is that people do all sorts of weird things that don't seem to make very good sense. And so you start wondering, oh, man. Now, it doesn't lead to total skepticism, because it's okay if a lot of what we do is kind of illogical. The only question is whether we have the capacity to reason and to evaluate evidence or not. And I think that we are called to do that. Because that's the thing that distinguishes us from the other animals, is our capacity to transcend, to think both into the past and into the future, and to act on the basis of evidence. This is not the things that probably any kind of animal can do. So let me give you one example of the behavioral economics, just so you can be freaked out by it, if I haven't freaked you out enough. So there's this funny study. It's a massive experiment with people to see what they would choose, okay? And so the experiment went this way, is that they would have people put their arm up to their elbow in 35-degree water and hold it there for 60 seconds. And then they could take it out if they could bear it, right, and then take it out. So I don't know if you've done that. That hurts really, really badly at that temperature. And so people would do that, but they wouldn't tell them it would be 60 seconds. The scientists are tracking that, and then people take their arm out. And then they wait, and they sort of rotate. They say, now we're going to do something another time. Right? And this time, unbeknownst to them, it will be 35 degrees. It's 35 degrees for 60 seconds. And then they warm it up by just a couple of degrees for another 30 seconds. So, right? So the first time, they put their arm in 35-degree water for 60 seconds. The second time, they put their arm in the water at that temperature for 60 seconds, and then another 30 seconds, a couple degrees warmer. And then they ask people later, okay, so which will you choose to do again? Guess what people do? Overwhelmingly choose the second option. And the reason is because they remember the slightly less pain at the end, even though they had actually endured all the same pain and some more. Now, that doesn't sound rational, but people overwhelmingly do that. And so what that means is that we tend to make decisions based on what we remember last, if we're not thinking about it. Right? So somebody tells you, and we all know this, okay, get butter, eggs, you know, and some of those bunion covers for my toes, right? You remember the bunion covers. That's, what was the thing before that? And so it turns out we make a lot of decisions based on the last thing we remember, weirdly. And so there's all sorts of things like that that are the results of behavioral economics. And I think just what it's teaching us is that people are remarkably complicated and do things for all sorts of reasons. And a lot of the time we do stuff that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, you know, but it doesn't mean that we always do that. So our goal is to sometimes do things that make some sense. You know, let that be our aspiration.
In regards to your talk for the first half of this morning, mm-hmm. have you done any research? You know, we used to think that oil and the natural resources, the energy ones mostly, were finite resources,
right.
But I've heard that there is some evidence saying that some of those are getting replenished. Have you studied?
Yeah, I do, and there's a guy named, I think his name is Thomas Gold. There are a couple of people that have hypothesized that there's that oil reservoirs are somehow produced by certain kinds of geological forces. And I would say it's maybe possible, but I've actually read a couple of books on this and followed it a little bit. People have generally not found it persuasive for really good reasons. But it is true that sometimes reservoirs, and so the data is, the kind of geological explanation is purely theoretical. They sort of say, well, maybe this could happen. But the evidence it's based on is that sometimes oil reservoirs will seem depleted and they'll seem to fill up again. And some of this may be the fact that, you know, we're discovering that hydrocarbons end up hiding in rocks and things that we didn't realize were there. That's why fracking is so successful. And so I tend to think that if we're talking about the actual volume in the Earth's crust, that the stuff is finite. Nevertheless, it doesn't follow that we're going to run out of it anytime soon or ever run out of it. And the reason is because there's an economic law that works. And so as a resource, long before oil would ever actually run out, it would get more and more and more difficult to acquire it, right? And the more difficult it is to acquire it, the more expensive it will be. That could happen now. So, for instance, let's imagine that it costs us $300 a barrel to get oil out of the ground because it was so hard to get. We would already be using a different form of energy at that point because it wouldn't be cost effective. And so that's why long before we ever got the last drop of oil out of the ground, it would not make any sense to use it. And so we'd do something else. And so that's what actually tends to happen with resources. And so people were panicked at one point in the 1600s in England that they were going to run out of forests because people were using wood for fuel. In fact, the forest did seem to become almost depleted. What happened is that wood for fuel became very, very extensive on the island of Great Britain. People discovered coal. They started using coal, and the forests returned. Then they panicked about coal, right? But see, the thing, what happens is that there's a conspiracy between, you know, the abundance or lack of abundance of a resource and the laws of scarcity. So that as things become more scarce and expensive, the price goes up, and then that causes you either to change to another source or to innovate a technology to do something different. So that's why I don't worry about, when I talk about energy, my opening quote is often, we will never run out of oil. Precisely because, I'm not saying it's infinite, I'm saying we would quit trying to use it once it got too hard to get, we'd do something else.
I apologize for such a doomsday type of question.
Yeah, we've had a few of those. So
I've read a couple different economists that say, don't be fooled, the recession isn't over, it's going to get worse, the bubble's going to pop. Mm-hmm. What are your feelings on that?
Yeah, we were talking about this last night with some folks, but I think there's two things going on. There's an unprecedented amount of fiscal profligacy and irresponsibility that's just absolutely unprecedented. And so, and it started in the 2000s. And I won't even give you the numbers, but the amount of deficit spending at the federal level is just utterly staggering. It's the sort of thing that people would not have imagined was possible even 25 years ago. But it's also, what's weird about it is that no one would have imagined we could have gone this far doing it without catastrophe. And so then the question is, why is that? Why isn't there already hyperinflation? And so what's happening is that we live at a weird moment simultaneously in which there's a huge amount of irresponsibility in terms of spending, especially by central governments. And the reason the countries still hold the dollar, every year somebody said, you know, dollar, the reserve currency, it's going to get dumped. I do not believe it because they got to dump it for something. What's it going to be, the yuan, the euro, right? Russian, I mean, what's it going to be? The other countries are worse off. And so weirdly, the dollar is still a pretty good bet. But what that means is that everybody, that's still not good news. If you're all going off the cliff and you just happen to be at the back of the line, you know, you're still going off the cliff. That's sort of where we are. At the same time, there are technological innovations that have never happened before in history that are not tracked by economic indicators. So all of the value that's tied up in the things that you do with your life because of a smartphone, what counts is the price of that smartphone, right? How much you paid for it, that'll show up, right, these economic indicators. But all of the actual value you get from that, it doesn't show up anywhere. And so there's all this actual intangible wealth being created that's kind of under the economic radar because economists don't have a way of tracking that. What's the price of value on me being able to not get lost in foreign cities because I have Siri? I don't know, but it's valuable, right? And so what's happening is all this economically untrackable economic value being created with government irresponsibility. And so I think that because of the intermix, we live at a very weird and almost mysterious time in which we don't, frankly, kind of understand what happens. Because on pure economic principles, hyperinflation should already have happened. And I'm at a loss, and everyone is at a loss to explain why it's not happening. And that's my best bet. Doesn't mean it's not going to happen, but it should have already happened. That's the point.
Regard to that Platinga thing.
Oh, okay. Oh, good. Yeah. Finally. It's my favorite part.
I read C.S. Lewis, who makes a very similar. Is that where that is? That the same thing?
It is. So C.S. Lewis, I've got an article. Discovery Institute has a book called The Magician's Twin, about C.S. Lewis. And I've got a chapter in there that compares Alvin Plantinga's argument with C.S. Lewis's argument in Miracles. He makes what he calls the argument from reason in 6 pages in the book Miracles. And he makes this argument at an intuitive level. And so if you want to know, like, okay, how do I just kind of get the basic argument? This is Lewis. He's a genius. He masters the vernacular. 6 pages, he gets the basic argument. What Plantinga's genius is he makes things of unparalleled rigor. And so for 20 years, he's been chiseling this piece of granite. And it's just absolutely irrefutable. And so the way C.S. Lewis makes the argument, it's kind of just intuitive, and there's ways to make philosophical objections. Its virtue is that it's comprehensible to normal people, right, that read English. And Plantinga's is the one you want if you want the rock solid one. And so I say use both of them. But yeah, and in fact, Plantinga's aware of the fact when he started developing this argument that Lewis makes the argument. Lewis himself got it from someone else, a man named Arthur Balfour. Arthur Balfour was a great British statesman. In fact, the Balfour Declaration that created Israel, he was a Christian, gave what are called the Gifford Lectures, and I think it was the 1920s, which are these lectures in Scotland that are was funded by a guy named Gifford for natural theology. And so Balfour wrote these lectures that are now published. It's called Theism and Humanism. It's a very good book. It's his lectures, and he's the first one that we can tell that developed this argument. Well, this was one of the 10 most influential books that C.S. Lewis read. And so what Lewis did is he popularized Balfour's argument, and what Plantinga did is he invigorated and made rock solid Lewis's argument. It's the most important, probably, it's kind of in terms of philosophical arguments and coming out of the Christian world, that's it. It's very powerful.
We're going to have to cut off the discussion. Jay will be around for a few minutes. We have an airplane to catch before too long. But first, we want to say thank you.
Thank you.
For your investment in Billings and in Montana. For those of you
Absolutely.
That came
Thanks so much. Thanks for coming out. I appreciate it.